to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. My name is Tom Caldwell. I'll be your host for this wonderful, wonderful episode. And joining me, as always, from Regina, Saskatchewan, Brandon Shea Matala. Say hi, Brandon.
Hi. Hi, how's it going?
Brandon's a little shy in the microphone.
No, I think I've just said about all I have to say about this movie.
That was it right there. And he hates it when I call him the foreign correspondent, our man in Leeds. Christopher Haig, how are you, sir?
I am very well. All the better for having you back on.
Well, I appreciate
that. Yeah, we missed Tom. Tom is finally sober.
I apologize for missing work. I will just say this. Get your vitamin B12 levels checked, everybody. It's important. I had a few days sick in January, so I'm looking forward to February. It's a whole new month. It's like minus 30 in Regina today, and a lot of snow in the yard, so I can think of nothing better than to sit inside and talk about Hitchcock with my Hitch brothers from around the planet here, so this will be good.
You know that you don't get paid for sick days at the Alfred Hitchcock podcast.
You know we don't get paid in general, right?
That's been something I've been meaning to bring up, actually. It's just like, when are the checks going to start, like...
We got t-shirts. I'm gonna be mailing Chris. He doesn't know this. I'm gonna be mailing him a poster. We get adulation from our friends and family. We get to talk about it at work. We get the odd hello on Facebook, but no, it's all good. It's a fun project. I'm really enjoying working with you guys on this.
It gives me reason to get like the Blu-rays and stuff. I just got for my birthday from my wife. I got the Criterion Blu-rays for Rebecca and Foreign Correspondent, so those are back-to-back movies that I didn't realize both of them were nominated for Best Picture, so that'll be fun when we get to those in fairly short order.
And despite having multiple compilations of Hitchcock DVDs lying around my house, I couldn't find Champagne. I have a case that says that I own a copy of Champagne, but I couldn't find the actual DVD. So I'm not the most organized podcast.
There might be a very good reason as to why you're just like, oh, I don't seem to have it in the house. It's just like, there's probably a very good reason for that, considering the film.
Yeah. You watched it and then threw it out the window.
Exactly.
I gotta say, if you take nothing else from this episode, please get your vitamin B12 checked.
Yeah.
Like, nothing about the film or anything. Just go away thinking, oh, I must get that checked.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Vitamin B12 Advisory Board.
Yeah.
By the letter B and the number 12.
And you might want some champagne before you watch this movie. Getting a little bit off topic, which I like to do because I'm easily distracted, I'd like to talk about champagne, the beverage, quickly here. So, to be clear, champagne is a sparkling wine. And to be legitimate, it has to be grown in the Champagne region of France, following rules that demand secondary fermentation of the wine, which creates the carbonation. So a lot of slang terms for sparkling wine where people call it champagne, but to be true champagne, it has to be from France. And that's a big deal. It's a big industry. They're very protective.
Port.
Yeah, they're very protective.
The wine port has to be made in the region of Port. I don't remember the full name of the town, if it's just called Port, but in Portugal, it has to be made there to be classified as a port.
I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but there's a big risk of eye injuries when opening a bottle of champagne. And they say that a 750 milliliter bottle can contain over 4 liters of carbon dioxide. That's three times higher than the pressure in a car tire.
Wow.
And... Wow. That little cork can shoot up to 13 meters when it comes out, and the distance to travel to your eyeball can be five 1/100ths of a second.
Yeah.
So, well, be very careful opening champagne bottles, kids.
I was going to say, I mean, the trick I learned when opening champagne is get it all ready and all that sort of thing, hold the cork and then turn the bottle.
Okay.
Not the other way around. Yeah. Or don't try and... like pull it or push it or anything. Now hold the cork, turn the bottle out, and it'll just come out easy as all, and there'll be no risk of like really ruining a party by blinding a guest.
It's all fun and games, right, until someone uses an eyeball.
Literally, it's just like, oh, it was really fun until someone sends it up in champagne and blinded three people.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, The other thing is, in movies, they always show people, like, you know, shaking it up and shooting it off, and then it, like, spurts everywhere, and they're like, this is how you drink champagne! Yeah. And it's like, no, that's how you ruin champagne.
Well, if you do it wrong, like they do on NASCAR every and football movie games, ever.
Yeah.
In the locker room, it's, by the time you take the cork out, half the bottle of champagne is on the floor, and you've thrown away all the contents, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very visual thing. And
like, just picture every time somebody drank a pop in a movie, they shook it up before they opened it. Like, and then it just went everywhere. Like, we would just, people would think it was ridiculous, but for some reason this is what people think you should be doing with champagne.
And an article from 2009 said there was the significance here from 1928, because that's the release year of our film, but there was a 1928 bottle of Krug champagne that sold at auction for $21,000 American. And that's the record at the time for an auction of a bottle of champagne. And I'm thinking, is it, they called it outstanding color and condition. Is it still drinkable after all that time? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't understand how that aging of alcohol works.
Yeah, alcohol doesn't have a chance to age around our house. It doesn't typically happen.
No. No, it should be fine. They've unearthed them where they've been like 100 years old, that sort of thing. In fact, there was a campaign a little while back, I think, for, it was either Moët and Chandon or it was Bollinger or something, where they had a director record a full film, and it was going to be encased in the vault with the champagne, and it was not to be open for like 100 years.
Wow.
So it's like a thing. I mean, it's also, I'm a bit annoyed because I'm like, oh, it could potentially be a really good film, but we're all going to be dead. Unless the whole, you know, it becomes like an altered carbon future where everybody just, you know, lives forever. So,
and they won't have the technology to play that film back. They'll all be like, "What's a Blu-ray player?" We have one.
Oh, no, I mean, I think it's a digital copy of the film. It's not like on, it's not like a disc.
It's not, we've already talked about the problems with
film
technology and aging.
True. Yeah. To be fair, and they're keeping it in like a, yeah, it's keeping it in a vault. So. Yeah.
You know, talking about the symbolism of champagne, right? Mm-hmm. It's always about decadence, wealth, prosperity, celebrating things. And that's where the millionaire in our film was a champagne industry guy. Like, he had a champagne company, right? That's where his money came from. Do you, Chris, want to give us your summary of the film?
Absolutely. I'm going to summarize some, or like condense some portions of it, because a lot of it can be boiled down very quickly, so I'm not going to spend too long being like, and here's the intricacies, if there's any intricacies of this film. So, the heiress Betty draws the ire of her father after using his aeroplane to fly to her beloved on an ocean liner headed for France. Due to seasickness, Betty's boyfriend is unable to dine with her once she boards the ship. However, she notices a man watching her, and he recurs throughout the film. Her father is very disapproving of the relationship, and thinks, oh, well, you know, the boyfriend's a bit unsuitable, she's not going to be accepted by her friends. Through a series of kind of arguments, her and her father argue, and her and her boyfriend argue. The father then tells Betty that he's lost the entire family fortune earned in the champagne business, and it's been wiped out in the stock market. The boyfriend leaves after hearing the news, and, you know, the father sees this as proof that the boyfriend was only after the money anyway. Betty then decides to sell her jewellery, but is robbed. She's penniless, and her father, you know, she and her father move into a small, shabby apartment. You know, the boyfriend tries to reconcile, but he and Betty keep on fighting. She thinks he's after her money. He thinks that she's been really awkward. Betty finds work at a swank restaurant. Soon, the mysterious man from the cruise liner turns up and invites Betty to his table. She becomes uncomfortable with the stranger and is relieved when her boyfriend once again arrives. The mysterious man leaves after handing her a note that advises her to call him if she ever needs any help. The boyfriend openly disapproves of Betty's job, and he leaves after a still angry Betty dances wildly to provoke him. Possibly the funniest thing I've ever read. I know, if I could provoke people by dancing wildly, I would have enemies everywhere. I'd love it. The boyfriend soon returns with Betty's father. He's outraged at Betty's unseemly job and confesses that he lied about the loss of their fortune to teach her a lesson. Rather than being pleased, Betty is Quite rightly, angered by both the father and the boyfriend, she turns to the mysterious man who offers to take Betty back to America. Betty gladly accepts, but is later horrified to find that she's been locked in her cabin. She imagines the worst about the mysterious man's intentions and is both relieved and delighted when her boyfriend arrives yet again and releases her from the cabin, allowing them to reconcile. The boyfriend hides in the bathroom when they hear the mysterious man approaching, who enters with Betty's father. The pair confess that he hired the man to follow and protect her. The boyfriend is furious and comes forth to attack the man, Betty's father pacifying the boyfriend's anger by telling him he no longer disapproves of their wedding. The reunited couple start discussing the wedding when, once again, another argument starts. Right, that sounds quite complex. It's not a complex film.
There's lots of fighting in this movie.
I just, yeah.
Well, and the whole, hey, honey, we're broke thing was a prank. That was him setting up his daughter.
I know.
And I'm like, I'm sorry, but people commit suicide over stuff like that. How is that a prank?
I'm going to say 1928, right about the time of the stock market and everything, and he's there going, do you know what? We're penniless now. We haven't got anything. And it's not like a prank as in, like, a bit of a joke. Oh, no, I'm only kidding. Like, he makes them move into, like, a crappy apartment.
This guy's committed to this farce.
Like... And then, weirdly, for such a, like, a, you know, a fluffy socialite, I'm really on Betty's side here. Because not only does her dad lie, he then gets annoyed when she gets a job. Yeah, she's there like, no, I have to get a job to, like, get money and everything. And he's there like, oh, it's unseemly.
He was mad when she lost the jewellery, too.
Yeah.
Like...
I don't know what I'd have done in better position. I might have snapped. You know, on that cruise ship, whatever the lies. I just, yeah.
She could jump overboard. It'd be rich woman overboard alert.
Okay, so let's rewrite this movie right now, where at the end when she finds out it's a lie,
Betty kills
them. She kills her dad.
Kills her dad, kills the boyfriend, kills them. So, does it on the...
And then goes to jail.
Oh, no. Does it on the cruise ship, because she's like, oh no, my father fell in and my boyfriend went to save him. Unfortunately, they're all dead. And it means now I'm the sole heiress to a champagne fortune.
Oh yeah, that's a happy ending.
Well, I mean, if she's the victim of this, she's supposed to be the main heroine, and you know she is a bit flighty. I mean, she does drive a plane into the sea.
Well, flighty.
To see her boyfriend, which I maintain that was so funny. I was, because I read it before I actually watched the film. I was like, how are they going to do that? He literally just goes boom,
and
straight in.
So I'm watching the beginning of the film, right, and the. They're putting the men on the lifeboat, and I'm like, are they evacuating the ship? Like, what's going on, right? And then it's like, these are the soldiers, these are the Navy men that are, their job from the cruise ship is to, let's go jump in a lifeboat and go pick up this heiress from the plane she crashed deliberately just because she wanted to get on board our transatlantic flight midway. You know, like, whatever.
Like, that's not frivolous. I don't need this plane. I want to get on this boat. Like,
what's going to happen to the plane? It's just going to sink. But there's always another one.
You know, because she couldn't just meet them in Paris or whatever. Like, I'm sorry.
Oh, I know.
But then she couldn't have fun on the boat.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate this film so much.
This movie was not very good. Like, you know, I messaged Chris.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
And I said... maybe Tom was in on it too. I said, when we did our episode on Downhill, because this movie reminded me a lot of Downhill, I said, we called the episode on Downhill, we called it, it's like Moonlight, but crap. And I messaged Chris and I said, we should call this, it's like Downhill, but crap.
Oh, it is. It infuriated me, the whole thing, because it's based on the fact that a father doesn't like her daughter's boyfriend, and rather than talking about it, decides to fabricate this whole farce, going, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pretend we have no money.
To
teach her a lesson. What is the lesson?
In the Bible of Hitchcock, the Hitchcock Truffaut book, Hitchcock himself talks and says, this was probably the lowest ebb in my output. He's talking about the film Champagne.
There is
no story. That's the trouble, he says. And Truffaut asks him, was the film an assignment from the company, or was it your own idea? And Hitchcock says, what happened, I think, is that someone said, let's do a picture with the title Champagne. You know, so that's you know, he's kind of like, well, here, let's rattle this off in 4 months. You know,
so they worked from the title backwards. They were like, do you know what's a really good name for a film? Champagne, great.
Yeah.
Now we've got the title, we just need to build the plot.
Yeah.
I mean, I read a little bit where they were saying, oh, it was going to be much more of like a serious film initially. And it was going to be a bit like, oh, it's the issues of like alcoholism and the alcohol trade in France and that sort of thing. And then they got the, I think the main actress's name is Betty Balfour, got her on board, and apparently because she's like a comedic actress, they were like, oh no, we've got to scrap that, you know, we have to make it lighthearted and all that sort of thing. I mean, it does. I mean, I know that the silent films aren't exactly known for their most thrilling, engaging plots, but this, it genuinely drove me mad, because there's nothing of any consequence. And I know it's supposed to be a bit of like, you know, oh, everything turned all right in the end, that sort of thing. But you've got no real likeable characters, you know. No one is punished in any way whatsoever. I just don't. I do not get it. I understand why Hitchcock was like, oh, this is a real, you know, yeah, it was a real low point. And I'm like, yeah, no, I've seen it. I agree.
Well, I've got this book as well. It's called Alfred Hitchcock, The Complete Films by Paul Duncan. And, you know, he's got these silent films. Some of them have something to say. Some of them just have a paragraph or whatever. Champagne and The Manxman encompass two sentences.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is what he says. So he's transitioning from the first sentence I'm going to read, he's talking a little bit about the farmer's wife. So Hitchcock puts a stamp on the film with a sequence where the passage of time is shown by the number of times the farmer's underclothes have been washed. Now we transition to the champagne. There were plenty of underclothes on display in Champagne, a female variation of Downhill. It's a dreadful movie, and it was followed by The Manxman, another variation on the love triangle, this time set on the Isle of Man, although filmed in Cornwall. That's all they have to say in this book on both Champagne and The Manxman. That's it. Like, I don't know, yeah.
Did you spot the review from 1928 by Variety? They say it's a weak film, an excuse for covering 7,000 feet of harmless celluloid with legs and close-ups. I love that.
Pretty much, yeah.
Like, what did that film stock do to deserve this?
It's also kind of a genius insult, really, isn't it? Just saying, it's literally just close-ups of legs. That's all it is. Mm-hmm.
You talk about, in the previous few films, we've talked about sexism and the attitudes and, you know, the treatment of women and the corniness. So this is a corny comedy. It's light comedy. But there is a lot of stuff that today we don't catch, or we don't really think of it as sexy or provocative. But back in the day, with the different moral standards, it would have been quite shocking a bit. But there's a scene in the talent office where Betty goes in, she wants to respond to an ad where they're looking for a tooth model because she has pretty teeth.
Oh, yeah.
And she's standing talking to the guy behind the desk that's handing out the assignments. And there's a man behind her that takes his foot and lifts up the back of her skirt to check out her legs. And I'm like, what? That's just corny. And, you know, if the guy tried that with a lady today, he'd probably get cuffed and, you know, nailed and punched to the floor. But in this film, there's a lot of that kind of cheesy, oh, we're going to show the legs from the knee down, la, 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 you know.
Like, most of the other movies that we've talked about so far, we've been able to find some type of social commentary to talk about. But, I mean, in this, there, like, I don't even know what there is to talk about. Like, there's some neat shots in the film, and I've got some back information whenever we get to the trivia, which is fine that we're jumping right in the movie, because I think we're just so frustrated with this film. And it sounds like Hitchcock himself was. You know, it's just something that he did to kind of fulfill his contract. And you know, like in the notes that I have, he was very interested in drinking a lot of champagne at this time, so he wanted to make a movie about champagne. And, I mean, okay, fine, I guess that's great, but I don't know. It just doesn't work, and this has no value. You know, I recently joined Letterboxd, and I'm ranking my films, and this is, like, way down on my list. Like, this is the lowest so far. Like, this is lower than Downhill. This is the lowest quality film we've seen so far.
I'm glad that in the general philosophy of our podcast that, you know, we talk about ourselves being Hitchcock fans and talking about the movies, but I'm glad that we're not shy to say when we don't like a film. We're not just being, we're not just promoting and being positive on everything. We're being honest. And that's important. And I think, I hope our, all 12 of our viewers appreciate that, our listeners. And, you know, it's okay to say no. It's okay to say we don't like the films. It's okay to say we have difficulty, especially with the silent films. Like, Brandon, you keep teasing us and saying we've only got two silent films left on our roster. And I think, you know, we're shoveling our way through them. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it. You should have to pay the price and do the work as a viewer and appreciator of films and know the history and know where they've come from and not always have everything handed to you on a silver platter.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And that's why I hope that somebody somewhere someday finds a copy of The Mountain Eagle, that second film of Hitchcock's that's still lost.
Mm.
You know, like, that is hugely important and something that I really want to see, no matter how good or bad it is. And again, now that we're going through it, I'm hitting these blind spots that I've never really had a reason to go and watch. You know, it is joyful to know that I'm completing my Hitchcock viewing experience, even though some of them are pretty painful. I mean, I've watched some bad movies in my life, you know, to just check them out because they're works by directors that I love. And as I get older, I seem to have less time to do that. So these were areas that I really thought I wouldn't get to. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to do this podcast, was to fill in those blank spots, those blind spots of my Hitchcock, you know, filmography and what I've watched of his.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of a school of thought which says, oh, well, can you actually be a fan of someone if you kind of blindly, you know, if you kind of go, oh yeah, everything done's amazing, every, you know, every film and all that sort of thing, saying you can't really be a fan, because what you're doing then is just paying lip service. So, like,
mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of Hitchcock, but he's made quite a few bad films. He's made quite a few films that are quite messed up and everything, but it's just, you have to be able to kind of, you know, like you've said, take the good with the bad and kind of understand that and try not to erase it. Try not to go, oh, well, you know, all of his films are pretty good. I mean, some of them are better than others, but it's like, no, just accept the fact that he was human and he made a film like Champagne.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay. It doesn't diminish him. It doesn't make him, you know, not a fantastic director. Of course it does. But you need to stop mythologizing it in the sense of like, oh, Hitchcock, you know, he's one of the great auteurs and all that sort of thing. He's never made a bad film. No, he has. We've covered several on this podcast alone. And it's fine. Right. It's fine to do that. You're not becoming less of a fan by admitting, you know, you need to accept the kind of going like, well, this one's great, this one's great, this one's great. However, these two or three pretty bad, and that's okay. Because I have seen the school of thought where it's just like, if you say anything negative, you're not a real fan. You know, if you say, you can be a Hitchcock fan and say, I don't really like Psycho. You can be a Hitchcock fan and say, do you know what, I don't actually
like... No, you can't say that, Chris. You can't say I'm a Hitchcock fan and not like Psycho. That's wrong.
You can.
I'm just kidding.
No.
Psycho?
But, you know, it's like, you totally can do it. You can be like, I really like Quentin Tarantino. But, okay, great example. I like Quentin Tarantino. I don't like Hateful Eight. Does it stop me from being a Tarantino fan? No, but I can accept the fact that it doesn't mesh. It doesn't, you know, a particular viewing thing doesn't always work for me as it does for everybody else. And I'm not going to sit there and lie and be like, oh, yeah, I really liked it, when I don't. You know, and it doesn't make you a better fan for lying about it. It just makes you a more dishonest one.
It shows that you're a fan, that you take the time to say yes and no to different pieces of work. You're not just blanket loving everything.
Yeah, exactly. You need to kind of, you know, just kind of get off this fan mentality. It's a bit like, you know, famous singers or actors, you know, people go, oh, you know, they've not made a bad film. Every film, I love it. It's going to be amazing. And even if the film or the album or whatever it is absolute crap, a lot of these fans will still defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
I'm sure there's people who love this movie, and that's fine.
Oh, listen, yeah. I mean, for all that we're
teasing
it, and if you really enjoy it and think it's quite a funny, you know, little film, totally fine. Go for it. We're not going to think any less of you. But
there might be people who think this is better than Downhill, and it's like, well, fine. You know, that could be either or. I mean, but whatever.
Yeah.
You know what's funny, Chris, is I actually just completed a Tarantino rewatch, and I watched Hateful Eight for the first time
two days ago.
And it's my least favorite Tarantino film as well. Yeah. But I attribute it a lot to the fact that I watched all of them in a short period of time.
Yeah.
And that they're so similar. So I want to watch it again with some distance, having not watched the other ones so quickly. But that's a little off topic.
No, but it's a fair point, though, in saying, you know, in the fact that, you know, we watch these kind of every few weeks before an episode and all that sort of thing. So we're seeing them kind of removed and everything. But then we could totally, if we did like three or four Hitchcock movies in a row, we could totally see Champagne and be like, you know, it's not bad actually. Mm-hmm. It's all about context. So,
yeah,
you know, and at the time, you know, we read, because Tom gave us that interview from Variety where it was like, it's, you know, meaningless, pointless, all that sort of thing. But I dare say there are people back then who would have really enjoyed it and who would have thought it was just a fun film. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't make them wrong. It just means it's a different opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Should I jump into my trivia now? We can maybe
add... Let's back up and do your trivia intro.
Yeah, we could do the trivia intro at the end here, which is okay too, because I think
this is our Tarantino-esque episode. We're all
on, I'm gonna say, it's all a bit Pulp Fiction. It's just all coming into the wrong sections.
As long as none of us die by the end of the episode, we'll be happy.
In a gruesome, bloody death. Okay, so Champagne is a 1928 British silent comedy film directed by Hitchcock and starring Betty Balfour, Gordon Harker, and Jean Braden. Screenplay was based on an original story by writer and critic Walter C. Mycroft. The film's about a young woman forced to get a job after her father tells her he's lost all his money. Now, Wikipedia lists the release date as August 20th, 1928, and it's the third of three films that Hitchcock released that year. According to most sources, Champagne originated with an idea by Mycroft, although Mycroft fails to mention the film in his published memoirs.
Ooh.
Which, after watching this movie, I probably would as well.
Completely understandable.
Champagne? I don't know what you're talking about.
The drink? I've never had any.
At a luncheon press conference held on the 14th of October, 1927 in London, studio chairman John Maxwell announced that he had signed Balfour, one of the country's most popular leading actresses and known as Britain's Queen of Happiness, and that her first role would be in Champagne, which would be directed by Hitch. Filming began in February of 1928 with only a partial scenario completed. During the filming breaks, Hitchcock and Stannard worked on new scenes. Assistant cameraman Alfred Room, working on one of his first films, later recalled that they didn't have a whole script. They wrote it on the back of envelopes on the way to the studio. You never knew what was going to happen. Room also remembered how the trick shot through the champagne glass was achieved. So there was a champagne trick shot at the beginning where it lifts up and the camera looks through it. I was the one who had to focus through the bottom of the glass. Hitch had it made specially by a glass manufacturer who put a lens into the bottom of the giant champagne glass so we could shoot through it and get a clear picture of what was happening at the other end of the room. We all said it wouldn't work. Most people said that of Hitch's ideas, but they almost always did work. Another crew member working on one of his first films was a stills photographer, Michael Powell, who would go on to become one of England's leading directors. In his biography, A Life in Movies, Powell recalled that Hitchcock detested Balfour and referred to her as a piece of suburban obscenity, possibly because he had hoped to make his next film with actress Annie Ondra. Now, we had mentioned Michael Powell once before. Now, he worked a lot, Powell and Pressburger, they did a lot of, like, musical-type films and whatnot. And, you know, I'm kind of going off the top of my head here, but I'm pretty sure it was Michael Powell that directed... We were talking about it, the Peeping Tom.
Oh, you mean the slasher movie in the 60s?
Yes.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure that it was Michael Powell that directed that. It was either Powell or Pressburger. I know it was one of the two of them, but I'm going to actually double check that while we're talking here.
Yeah.
But that's kind of interesting that Michael Powell had worked with him at one time. Michael Powell was the director.
Peeping Tom, 1960, Michael Powell.
Yeah. Shortly after completing Champagne, Balfour and a few of the other cast members made a second film for BIP and Austrian company, Sasha Film, titled Champagner in Austria. Palace Deluxe in France and Bright Eyes in English-speaking countries was the name of it elsewhere. Despite the similarity in titles, the two films have little in common apart from the actors. So Betty Balfour played Betty, and she was a silent English screen actress known as British Mary Pickford and Britain's Queen of Happiness. Her sympathetic portrayals were often tinged with pathos. Balfour was the most popular actress in Britain in the 1920s, and in 27 was named by the Daily Mirror as the country's favorite world star. Like fellow actor Eva Novello, Balfour resisted the temptation to break into Hollywood films and instead focused her career in Europe, including appearances in Marcel Lebrier, Le Diable au Cour, and Louis Mercanton's Croquette, and Geza von Bulveri's Bright Eyes.
We've just offended half of Europe, so well done.
I apologize.
It's fine.
At least they're listening.
Yeah.
Her career in England most spanned the 20s and 30s, and most notably her portrayal of the lead character in the Squibb series of comedies and in Alfred Hitchcock's Champagne. By the mid-30s, film roles had dried up, and her final screen appearance was alongside Gordon Harker in Henry Cass's 29 Acadia Avenue. Her marriage to composer Jimmy Campbell failed in the early 40s, and Balfour was unable to reignite her acting career. A virtual recluse for the last two decades of her life, she died in November of 1977, at age 74. Her death went largely unreported in the major British newspapers. Now, Gordon Harker played Mark, Betty's father. We've spoken about him several times during The Ring and Easy Virtue, and he will return for his final Hitchcock appearance in Elstree Calling in 1930. Gene Braden, the boy, there's not much information on him, but Hitchcock's own says that he's sometimes known as Gene Brodier, and he was a French actor. Broden appeared in over 20 films, mostly filmed in France and Germany, including Moulin Rouge from 1928, Miss Europe from 1930, and Remontant les Champs-Élysées from 1938. He died at age 70. And finally, Ferdinand von Alten was the man. Also not much on him, and Hitchcock Zone says Ferdinand von Alten was a Russian-born German actor who appeared in nearly 100 films in his 15-year career, and he died from influenza at age 47. Now, Hitchcock was also not in this movie, so that's the end of my report.
Even Hitchcock wouldn't be in this film.
Yes.
I'm not even going to cameo in this. I'm just...
Excellent.
Yeah. Oh, it's a shame about Betty Balfour, actually, reading about her kind of life. It's a shame.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, is there anything else we can say?
I'm okay with having a short episode of this one.
Yeah. Rotten Tomatoes, the audience score on this film is 18%. I would have to agree and give it one cold bottle of champagne out of five. And, gentlemen, do you have a ranking on this?
I will give it one wasted plane in the ocean out of five.
I will give it one crazy dance.
I still...
Okay, go ahead. We're waiting. We've got Brandon on camera in the chat room. We're waiting for your crazy dance.
I still love that as a description, just like she infuriates him by dancing wildly. I'm like...
One infuriatingly wild.
If only modern day feud were that simple.
Mm-hmm.
If you just
I'm going to do a quick piece of viewer mail here. We'd like to thank Brandon Herbecki from Arizona for his attention to our show. He's always commenting and giving us feedback. He wrote on Facebook, "Thank you for putting these episodes out. He hasn't seen these films, but he finds our discussions fascinating. He likes the commentary on which culture chooses to ostracize or shun in the 1920s and today. And he also dug the description of the monocle camera trick."
Mm-hmm.
That would be the episode he's referring to. Mm-hmm. So we always appreciate your feedback, your input, your comments. We've got all our social media avenues, all sorts of ways to get hold of us. We really hope to be able to encourage, we'll keep you updated as to what film we're going to do next. And hopefully if people have a chance to view these films and give us questions or comments ahead of time, we'll try as much as we can to incorporate that into the episodes mm-hmm. when we record them.
Yes, and coming up next, we're going to be doing The Manxman, which is our final silent film, which I'm very excited that we're done the silent era. This has been a lot of silent movies, more than I think I've doubled the amount of silent movies I've seen in my life now by watching these 8 by Hitchcock here, so...
I'm glad that Chris was able to find a link to this film with music. The original version on YouTube had no music. And like, I can't do that.
You just got to sit there and play the piano while you watch it. Just do, 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 do.
The music piece that we watched, it was pretty much piano throughout. I think, Chris, your comment was that it was probably modern.
It sounded like it was just a modern dub. Because I don't know how to describe it, but it just didn't sound like it was 1920s classical music. I don't know the reference.
It was appropriate, though. I found the score appropriate.
Yeah, it sounded like it was from a CD or something.
I got the impression that it was custom, custom for the film. There was a doorbell rung at some point, I think, in the film, and the music kind of, referred to a doorbell sound. Like, I like it when you do that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, there may be no record at all of the score of the original music. Some of these films were live musicians in the theater, a piano player or an orchestra in the room. So they may have no way to refer back to what the original music was.
Oh yeah, like it struck me when we were going through it, and I was just like, oh yeah, that actually makes sense, given the fact it is one of the, I think it's the Hitchcock 9? Like the 9 missing films, and they did find like negatives of it and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it makes sense. It sounds modern because it's a replication of what the soundtrack might have been like. So yeah, that was my only real quibble with the, I guess, sound aspect of it. But it's a silent film anyway, so mm-hmm. it's fine. It's fine. I found the film more annoying than the music. So.
Brandon, you watched the version on DVD. Mm. It obviously had a soundtrack attached to it.
Yeah, there was some recognizable classic tunes. I don't know what all of them were, but there was at points where there was the one where there's the one that they usually have when people graduate in movies, like that. Yeah, that was in there.
Now we're gonna have to pay
royalties
on humming. As we come to the close of our show, we want to say hello to our sister podcast known as Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. Now they...
Hi, Annie. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Annie and Catherine. And they are talking about the classic anthology television series brought to you by the Master of Suspense. As they say, mystery, check. Trivia, check. Humor, attempted. And this is their tribute, their review of the television shows. Any thoughts on their cast so far, guys?
I've listened to all of them so far. As of us recording now, there's been 3 episodes released, and I'm actually watching the episodes for the first time while I'm watching while I'm listening to the podcast, and I'm enjoying it. It's a lot of fun. So if you are familiar with the show or not, they do a pretty good summary of them as well. As they say, you can find them on the States and Hulu. But they're also available on DVD, and it's finally given me a chance to watch them. And I haven't enjoyed all of them. We will be talking about a couple of episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents as we go along, because Hitchcock himself did direct a few of them. So we're just going to cover the ones that Hitch directed, while Annie and Catherine are going to be covering all of the episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
I was going to say, I've not had time to listen to them all, but I did listen to the first episode, which was Lamb to the Slaughter. And it's really funny. It is a really funny podcast. And they are fantastic hosts and everything. So yeah, I really would check it out. It's on iTunes, and I can't think where else it is.
They're
everywhere. I'm really bad at doing this sort of thing, which is like, we're on iTunes and everywhere else.
And Brandon's been very busy lately getting our distribution widened on a variety of applications all over the web. Thank you for your work on that.
Yeah, we now have our own independent feed. You can find us on Google Play Music. You can find us on Spotify, which is great. You know, Spotify has their own podcasting area. So you can listen to us just about everywhere else. And as always, we are still available in the Fandom Podcast Network Masterfeed. And you can find them on Twitter at FanPod Network. And we want to thank the guys at Fandom Podcast for helping us out and helping distribute our show. So you can get us in 2 wonderful places on your on your mobile device as well. So please give us a rating and review as well on iTunes, because that'll help us grow and help people find us.
Brandon, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and you can find me over on Trek FM, where I host two Star Trek podcasts, one of which is called The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast, and the other one is called Warp 5, with my new hosts, Brandy and Patrick, where we're talking about Star Trek Enterprise. And Chris, where can people find you when you're not infuriating them with your dance moves?
Actually, I was going to be offended that I got the reference on. I was just a bit like, okay, that's fine. I thought you were just shading me a bit then. You can find me in real life panicking about what to write my master's thesis on. On the webs, you can find me at Twitter at @higher_boy. Apart from Good Evening, I also do a podcast with my best mate Emma Platt, North by Nerd West, which is very chatty and nerdy and fun, and we basically just chat anywhere from 40 minutes to 2 hours on kind of geeky topics and all that sort of thing. We have a lot
2 hours?
I know. Well, that's the thing, though. Wow. We're only supposed to be doing like a 40-minute thing, and then we've been talking for like an hour before, and I was like, oh, we haven't recorded any of this. But yeah, and I also pop up on podcasts such as Smorgasbord and also Eccentric Earth, which is a brilliant new podcast by Amy Walker about the cool, weird stories that people don't always talk about in human history. So yeah, definitely check those out as well.
I'm known as Tom Caldwell 3000 on Twitter and the Tom Caldwell on Instagram, except no imitations. So as we like to wrap up the show, I would like to bid you good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.